Jeff Schessel is the author of the new book, Mercury Rising. Before that, he was a speechwriter for President Bill Clinton and a founding partner of West Wing Writers. He's also a Rhodes Scholar and holds degrees in history from Oxford, Brown, and frequently contributes to the New York Times. The new book, Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War, is a history of the epic orbital flight that put America back into the space race. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jeff Schessel to the roundtable this morning. Jeff, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to this particular subject?
Well, I grew up reading about, seeing movies about John Glenn. I always was struck by his powerful, his charismatic personality and the incredible stories of the early space race. And I when I pursued the subject a little further about 5 or so years ago, it struck me that there was a lot more to John Glenn than the Boy Scout, the Sunday school teacher that's so often portrayed in movies and in books, that there was an edgier, more interesting character there. He was more ambitious. He was more fiercely competitive. He was, in fact, among the original Mercury 7 astronauts, he was the most decorated combat veteran of all of them. And that was a side of John Glenn I didn't understand, and it drew me deeper into his story.
So give us a sense of going deep into that story. Obviously, you had interviewed his kids. You had obviously went into the Glenn archives and really have a lot of these handwritten notes that were available to you. Give us a sense of that process.
You know, it's a wonderful thing for any historian who wants to understand not only John Glenn, but that period of time and that in the history of the space race, that John Glenn saved everything. I mean, this is someone not just once he became an astronaut or once he became a senator in 1974. This is someone who was saved everything from when he was a kid. And so in his archives, you find pamphlets that he was collecting when he was 12 years old, route maps for Pan Am and TWA. He was so obsessed with flight, even though he was never going to get to fly on any of those planes. His family didn't have the money to send him on Pan Am to some distant location. He was collecting these things and he saved them. And so as you extend forward through his life, he saved his letters home, or his wife Annie saved his letters home from World War II, his diary entries from that period of time. And when you move forward into the space race period, Glenn saved all of his flight plans and all of the briefing books that he received at NASA, and he marked them up at the time with notes, sometimes pretty frank comments in the margins of these things. And so you really get a window into what John Glenn was thinking at the time, and also some of his struggles within NASA. None of this was available to the public at the time. It was all for one for all as far as the public was concerned. But there were a lot of struggles going on internally between Glenn and the other astronauts, and also between Glenn and NASA officials, who were not particularly interested in having Glenn or any of the other astronauts really fly those capsules that they were in. They wanted them to just sort of sit there and report on how it was going while the autopilot did all the work. And so all of this was recorded in real time by John Glenn, and it gave me the opportunity to really bring a lot of this more to life than I had seen in previous accounts.
Give us a sense in that bringing it more to life of how you think that perhaps in the past and in the recollection of the space race of how it has been portrayed, because you take a slightly different look at it.
Well, that's right. I think one of the things when it comes to Glenn's flight, or when it comes to the space program overall, the 1960s, is that we know we won, right? We know we got to the moon. We know that the Soviets didn't. We know that John Glenn in 1962 orbited the Earth, and we know that he came back okay. There were setbacks. There were tragedies over the course of the 1960s, but we have a pretty good sense of how it all turned out. That obviously was not clear to them in the moment. And one of the things that I try to do in Mercury Rising is to restore the sense of peril, the sense of existential danger that hung over the program. And I do mean existential. The context of all of this was the Cold War. This was why we were engaged in this race with the Soviets. This was not a race in the sense of, you know, a good-natured competition between two countries, like the Olympics or something like that. This was a question of who was going to dominate this new arena of the Cold War. And the Soviets in 1957 with Sputnik, and then after that, a series of achievements, they burst out to such a significant lead that there was a lot of worry in the United States. And I mean, serious worry, not only that we were behind, but that we would never be able to catch up and that the consequences of that would be profound. John Kennedy, when he ran for president in 1960, said, if the Soviets control space, they can control the Earth. And that was a widespread fear.
You write about JFK using a term called the hour of maximum danger. Talk about that a little bit.
He was really talking about nuclear apocalypse, which, of course, hung over everything beginning in the 1950s and very acutely in the early 1960s, as Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet premier, seemed really determined to challenge the United States aggressively on every front. Just before Kennedy took office, Khrushchev promised wars of liberation against the capitalist powers around the world, against the United States. There was a challenge in Berlin in that divided city. There was a challenge in Cuba, which had just been taken over by the communists. There were challenges in Southeast Asia and Laos and, of course, in Vietnam. There was a sense that democracy and the United States in particular was under siege around the world. So when Kennedy talked about the hour of maximum danger approaching, it was this determination of the Soviet Union to press aggressively. Kennedy was worried that the harder they pressed, that the closer we would get to a simple mistake creating a nuclear holocaust, that somebody would miscalculate. And that would really end life as we knew it. And so this hung over everything, and it certainly hung over the space race, which was seen as part of the same picture.
Do you see an evolution of John Glenn's thinking of how important that flight on Friendship 7 was to the nation?
Absolutely. I mean, Glenn always understood that this was important to our national security. It was important to the way America was seen around the world. Were we seen as a credible challenge to the Soviet threat? Was democracy seen as a system that could actually get us to a better future? Or was communism the wave of the future, as the Soviets were always claiming? And so Glenn understood that. The other astronauts understood that at the beginning of the program. But by the time Glenn finally got his chance, after delay, and once Glenn was scheduled for that orbital flight, his flight was scrubbed 10 times over the course of 4 months, scrubbed for all kinds of reasons, technical problems of just about every variety, weather problems that prevented the flight from lifting off successfully, all sorts of problems. And in the meantime, the Soviets were continuing to press forward. As I said before, they built the Berlin Wall. They began to test new and more powerful nuclear weapons in the summer of 1961. So by the time Glenn finally gets to fly, the sense of danger, that maximum danger that we were talking about a minute ago, has become really profound. And the feeling is that if Glenn can't get into space, if a tragedy befalls the mission, as many feared it would, that it would put America really permanently behind the Soviet Union, not just in space, but militarily and in every other facet as well.
Jeff Schessel is the author of the new book that we're talking about this morning, and it is Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. It is published by Norton. I can't imagine the pressure that puts on anyone, but certainly the role that John Glenn has in, oh, by the way, John, you basically have to restore America's faith in itself.
That's right. That's right. No small mission there. And the incredible thing about Glenn is not just that he understood it, but that he felt on a certain level like he was up to it. And you could call that arrogance or you can call it anything else. But Glenn had this almost supernatural sense of self-confidence and self-belief, and he radiated that. And it sounds corny to say this, but really it's very true that just looking at John Glenn, just listening to John Glenn, made a lot of Americans just feel better about themselves, better about their future, better about the space program. There was certainly a lot of danger attached and a lot of worry about Glenn. Mm. But he was really straight from central casting, not just to calm the fears of a worried nation, but also to represent what many felt were the best qualities of America, the best values, and also the kind of boldness, the sense of adventure that many felt had been lost in the late 1950s, in the years after World War II, that America had just settled into a little too much love of its own consumer culture and just was not trying hard enough, was not pushing itself hard enough to compete with the Soviets. But Glenn suggested otherwise, and that was another reason why his mission was so important, because now he had to prove it.
What were the fairly regular communications like between Glenn and his superiors and the president? I mean, how much were they all metaphorically in the room with each other?
President Kennedy wasn't too involved. In fact, he really wasn't involved at all for the first few months of his administration, and it wasn't until the Soviets sent the first man into space and achieved that milestone in April 61, the flight of Yuri Gagarin, that Kennedy finally recognized that he needed to kick the space program into high gear, and he needed to commit to that. But in terms of his active involvement, he was very interested in it. He understood the stakes of it were profound, but he didn't get involved in day-to-day management in any way. He really trusted in James Webb, who was the NASA administrator, and the folks running the program. And he knew he needed to give them room to do their thing. In terms of Glenn and NASA officials, they were really in constant conversation because there were so many open questions about the mission, what the mission was supposed to do, when the mission was going to go, was this component ready, was that rocket safe? And in this environment where lives were at stake and our national prestige around the world was at stake, tempers got pretty heated. It was Glenn's life on the line, and he did not always feel that his bosses at NASA had his best interests in mind. They seemed more interested in having astronauts kind of quietly follow orders and just, you know, flip the switches they were supposed to flip and run the tests they were supposed to run, and not use this incredible expertise they had behind the controls. It was why they were chosen for the program, but Glenn felt that they were never being given the chance to use their abilities to the fullest.
Obviously, he had great faith in the program and was moving forward and felt that he could do the job. But he had contingency plans. I mean, you're right. He had drafted a letter to his kids in case he was killed.
He did. He drafted not only a letter, but after sending the letter, he then sat and brooded a little more in isolation in Cape Canaveral as he was waiting for his flight to finally go. And he realized that he hadn't said everything that he wanted to say. And so what I found at the Glenn Archives, and this had never been published before, was a script that he wrote on yellow legal paper, a script for a reel-to-reel recording of a message to his kids, who were teenagers at the time, in case he didn't come back alive, and also a message to his wife, Annie. And it's very chilling reading. It's very, very personal. And he begins by saying, "If you hear this, I've been killed." Mm. And he talks in this script, he talks to his kids about his feeling about the afterlife. He very much believed in the afterlife. He even talked about sending them a signal from the afterlife to let them know that he was okay on the other side. He talked to them about the funeral, which would happen at Arlington, and the fact that there would probably be no body to bury, and how he wanted them to conduct themselves. And he talks also about courage and about fear, and that he feels that courage, above all, is the ability to reckon with fear. It doesn't mean fearlessness. It doesn't mean you have no fear. It's about the ability to handle it. And he wanted them to know that if he didn't come back alive, that he was someone who had managed his fear and did not die as a coward, in his words.
In hindsight, how did his kids look back on that moment and think to themselves, that the very real possibility that their father may perish?
His kids were very aware of that possibility. They were aware at the time, and they certainly have ruminated about that in years since. They because they were teenagers, they knew what was going on. They understood the risks, and Glenn had always been honest with them. He always tried to instill confidence in them by teaching them as much about the machinery as he could, so it wasn't a mystery to them, so they understood how it worked and that it was going to work. But they knew, you know, they were, because Glenn was the oldest of the Mercury 7 astronauts, his kids were the oldest, and so they were very plugged in. Some of the other kids of other Mercury astronauts were really young and just not old enough to know what was going on or to remember it today. But boy, they knew what was going on, and every once in a while they would let something slip to a reporter. At one point, a reporter asked Lynn, Glenn's daughter, who was 14, they said, "Are you excited that your father's going to get to go on this orbital flight?" And she said, "Yeah, if he comes back." Mm. And so, you know, sometimes with the innocence of teenagers, they let the nation's press know how they really felt about it. It was tough. It was tough for them.
Jeff Scheschel is the author of Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. Obviously, eyes are on this prize, very much so. But how much was this? The elephant in the room was the trip to the moon, right? I mean, that was always sort of the next step, and I assume that figured into all of the planning in this mission.
Well, Project Mercury was underway and along this track essentially before Kennedy had made his commitment to try to send Americans to the moon. That commitment didn't come until May of 61. Mercury had been created in late 1958. There certainly was the sense that this was the goal. There was a lot of talk about it. There was a kind of fantasizing about it, whether that fantasizing was going on within the Pentagon or in comic books. There was a focus on the moon. But really, the commitment wasn't made real until Kennedy said it out loud. And even then, actually, a lot of Americans thought it would never happen. They thought it wasn't worth the money. It wasn't worth the effort. And in fact, many in NASA, as I found from talking to some of them, didn't really feel like it was all that real. It was Glenn's success that finally gave the moonshot some credibility. It was only after Glenn succeeded in becoming the first American to orbit the Earth that it actually seemed possible that, you know what, it's going to take a lot of work. There are no guarantees, but we just might be able to do this.
And when you look at the history of the space program with its great successes, but also its great defeats and tragedies, we're still in that moment, right? We're still in that time where we have to prove to the American people that it is worth it. It's expensive and it's worth it, and this is what we'll get out of it. And that seems like it'll always be the case of trying to explain that to the American people.
I think that's right. It's always very expensive, very difficult, and very dangerous to reach these goals. I mean, we're committing, it seems, the United States to go back to the moon. President Biden has reaffirmed that commitment. Just because we've done it before and done it successfully doesn't mean it won't be dangerous. It doesn't mean that there isn't risk. And of course, we're now setting our horizons even farther away to Mars. And I think not only the old concerns about risk and the old concerns about cost will come up, but also the questions of whether it's worth it. Why are we doing this? And there was a sense after the United States got to the moon and then went back to the moon, you know, a number of times over the following few years, what were ordinary Americans getting out of this? And was it really worth the billions of dollars? It was exciting, but what was the practical benefit of it? And it's one of the reasons that we haven't gone back in 50 years, because these questions were never answered definitively at the time. I think today nobody regrets that we went to the moon, but I think people would be hard-pressed to say that, therefore, our lives are different in these ways.
How did you come away? I guess the better question is, did you come away thinking about John Glenn any differently than you went in?
I absolutely did. I think that Glenn seemed to me to be a much more complex and sometimes conflicted person than he's ever appeared in popular culture, or than he appears in, if you watch, if you go on YouTube and you watch old NASA films of the period. He's always calm, he's confident, he's cheery, he's sunny. And the reality is that he's a human being. And these were dangerous things that he was in the middle of doing, and stakes were high and tensions were high, and there were a lot of battles that he had to fight just to do his job every day. And so, I mean, to me, it doesn't make him any less of a hero at all. I mean, what he did was incredible, and it was incredibly important. But it makes him more of a human being, and just as complex as anybody else. I mean, what I wanted to understand when I got into this is how to square that Boy Scout image of John Glenn with something that his wingman in Korea, Ted Williams, the Red Sox left fielder, was Glenn's wingman in Korea, incredibly. What Ted Williams said about Glenn, he said, "The man is crazy." And I thought, Glenn? John Glenn is crazy? What does that mean? He sure doesn't look crazy. But then you hear the stories about what Glenn did in Korea and the ferocity of John Glenn as a fighter pilot and his willingness to, he's under attack. His commanding officer tells him to get out of there. He circles back anyway, and he goes in for another attack, and he gets a hole blown in the tail of his jet the size of a basketball. And he somehow manages to get this plane back to base. There are multiple stories like this about Glenn. He was a seriously tough guy, but unlike the other astronauts, he didn't walk with a swagger. He didn't feel like he needed to act like a tough guy. He was just gonna be one, in fact.
Jeff Schessel is the author of the new book, Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. The book is published by Norton. Jeff, thanks very much for joining us. A great pleasure to have you on our program.
Thank you, Joe. Great talking to you.
And to you. Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Mercury Rising. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.